Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The Obama administration on Friday quietly scrapped a program designed to help insure Americans for long-term care, home health assistance, the nursing home years. The so-called CLASS Act was part of the sweeping Obama health care reform. Now it's suspended, effectively gone before it began. Too expensive. So what are we going to do? This hour on Point, the crisis in long-term elder care. We'll hear in a moment from a Texas Republican glad the Obama plan for long-term care is gone. We're joined first today from Washington by Howard Gleckman, a fellow at the Urban Institute and the author of Caring for Our Parents, Inspiring Stories of Families Seeking New Solutions to America's Most Urgent Healthcare Crisis. Howard Gleckman, welcome.
Hi, Tom. Good to be with you.
What just happened here, Howard?
Well, what happened was when Congress adopted the Affordable Care Act, a piece of it was, as you said, the CLASS Act. The Secretary of Health and Human Services was given a period of time during which she was supposed to actually develop insurance policies, an actual policy that people could choose to buy.
And this is CLASS Act as in Community Living Assistance Services and Supports. But anyway, there it was.
Right, right, which is a voluntary national long-term care insurance program. Essentially, mm-hmm. What would happen is you would have the opportunity to buy an insurance policy from the federal government, which you could use to fund your long-term care should the time come that you need it. It would pay a benefit somewhere in the neighborhood of $50 or $60 a day. No one knew what the premium would be. The goal was to try to keep the premium below $100 on average.
$100 per month?
Per person.
Okay.
Per month.
Mm-hmm. That you would pay earlier in your life so that at some point, if you needed it, it would be there.
That's right. And okay. and it would be adjusted for your age, so the younger you bought, the less expensive it would be.
Mm-hmm.
But in any event, the secretary was required to actually design an insurance policy based on the language of the act. She determined very early on that if she just tried to design these policies based on the specific formula included in the law, she couldn't do it. But she said that she thought that she had the legal authority to very broadly interpret the language of the CLASS Act, so she could still design a policy that would look something like what the law said, but it wouldn't look exactly like what the law said. So she hired some actuaries. They have been working busily for the last year or so trying to figure out some way to do it. They came out with a report. She looked at it, and she said, I don't think I can make this work. And she announced the other day that essentially the whole thing is suspended, that while the law is not repealed, the Obama administration is not going to issue any policies. So there'll be nothing to buy.
So it's essentially
gone. One other point about this mm-hmm, is yeah. that if you actually read the actuary's report mm-hmm. and some of the other supporting documentation, the actuary said he thought there was a way to make this work. It wouldn't be a big plan. It would probably only have a few million participants, but it could be sustainable. It would require, though, a very expansive interpretation of the law on Secretary Sebelius's part, and she did not want to do that.
Now, you and others have pointed out that this thing, there was this kind of jaundiced eye on this from very early on. This had been championed by the late Senator Ted Kennedy for a long, long time. It turned out, dying days when this was being considered, and nobody wanted to get in the way of it. For quite a while now, we've had the Secretary of Health and Human Services, Sebelius, saying it might need to be reformed or repealed. Here she was all the way back in February. You may have probably heard this, Howard, but here was Kathleen Sebelius on this long-term care piece.
While the law outlined a framework for the CLASS Act, we determined pretty quickly that it would not meet the requirement that the act be self-sustaining and not rely on taxpayer investments.
So it looked rough right there, but all the way back in 2008, this is a couple of months after recovering from brain surgery, Ted Kennedy, who was at the Democratic National Convention then, talked about his big legislative dream. This was a piece of it, this kind of care.
And this is the cause of my life, new hope, that we will break the old gridlock and guarantee that every American, north, south, east, west, young, old will have decent, quality health care as a fundamental right and not a privilege.
You can hear the old Ted Kennedy passion. He was talking the whole package, but this was a part of it he cared a lot about. Howard Gleckman, people saw early on that this would not meet what the Judd-Gregg Amendment, which required 75 years of numbers to add up as it stood there in the legislation. But there were savings in the early years when they would be collecting these premiums but not yet paying out. President Obama was not hesitant about claiming those savings as part of what he presented to the country as the cost savings of his health care reform, was he?
No, he wasn't. This is the paradox of this whole issue. They probably never would have gotten the Class Act passed if it were not for this claim that the $70 or $80 billion in premiums it would collect over the first several years of the program was going to help pay for the rest of the health reform law. It probably was necessary to get the thing passed in the first place. However, by doing that, they also sowed the seeds of its demise because it was a budget gimmick. Now, it was simply building on the conventions that the Congressional Budget Office uses to score any legislation. There wasn't any separate deal going on here. This was not a Bernie Madoff Ponzi scheme.
But you could look at the first 10 years and you could see those savings. But if you looked on out, as this big wave of boomers and others come in, it turned into a hole they didn't know how to fill.
This is an insurance program. So essentially what happened is they would collect premiums over the course of the early years, and then they would pay them out later. And that's kind of the nature of any kind of long-term care insurance. It's the way private long-term care insurance works as well. But it created an opening for the critics, including, and not just Republicans, but including some very important Democrats like Ken Conrad, the chairman of the Senate Budget Committee, mm-hmm. who was also extremely critical of this. But I think you need to go back a step. You know, it's very important to keep in mind the problem that we're dealing with here. 10 million Americans require long-term care today. 20 million will require it over the next couple of decades. We do not have a system in place to finance that care. Most people rely on personal savings until they run out of money. We know that Americans don't save very much. Half of Americans have financial assets of less than $55,000 after age 65. Long-term care, if you're in a nursing home, costs $75,000 a year. You can see the numbers don't add up.
Yep.
We don't save for it. Only 7 million Americans have private long-term care insurance. Private long-term care insurance is a market failure. It's a product that nobody wants to buy.
People
turn to Medicaid.
Mm-hmm.
Medicaid pays for almost half of all long-term care today, and it is a system which is itself under enormous financial pressure.
And it only kicks in once you've exhausted. It only kicks in once you've exhausted your personal resources. So there's that big hole in the road. Individuals don't know how they're going to pay for it. The government doesn't know how it's going to pay for it. And yet, people are aging. They're going to need services like this. Howard Gleckman, please stand by. I want to welcome right now from his home in Lewisville, Texas, Republican Congressman Michael Burgess. He's a doctor and longtime critic of this Class Act. Congressman Burgess, welcome back to On Point. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, John. Critic of the Class Act, but a believer in long-term care insurance. And I didn't realize I was a member of such a small group, but I am one of the 7 million who owns a long-term care policy. I have done so since prior to coming to the Congress. And I did so on the advice of my mother, who told me if I didn't buy it when I was 50, I couldn't get it when I was 80.
Yep.
And there is no more loving gift that a parent can give to their child than the knowledge, the secure knowledge, that their children will not be called upon to finance care in their in someone's elder years. So it is an investment that I have made, my wife has made. I wish it were tax deductible. I am working on perhaps allowing that if we don't reform the tax code in its entirety. That would be a good thing for us to work on. But the Class Act was never designed to work. And as a consequence, well, it's really just emblematic of so many things that were wrong with the Affordable Care Act. This was placeholder language inserted by Harry Reid. Yes, it was a tip of the hat to Senator Kennedy. And it was not ready for prime time when it was put into the bill that was passed by the Senate. The bill that was passed by the Senate was never expected to be signed into law. But with the loss of the seat in Massachusetts when Scott Brown replaced the seat that had previously been held by Senator Kennedy,
right.
Harry Reid lacked 60 votes, And the only thing they could do was push this thing through the House, which is exactly what happened.
What do you think is going to happen down the road, Dr. Burgess, Congressman Burgess? I mean, you've got private long-term care insurance. You're one of 7 million who do, and that's great. If those companies stick around and keep offering it, all the other ifs there. But a whole lot of Americans don't. What do you think will happen without some kind of, you know, shared insurance here?
Well, and one of the biggest problems I had with the CLASS Act was because it gave people the illusion that, oh, now I've got long-term care insurance thanks to the Affordable Care Act and the government. But in fact, the CLASS Act wasn't long-term care insurance. It was a bit of a supplemental benefit that that could be used, but it was in no way, shape, or form intended to replace either a private long-term care insurance policy or that which is provided by Medicaid. And honestly, people of my generation, the 50 and 60-year-olds, need to be talking about this, need to be thinking about this. Many people can't afford it. You're right. There perhaps are more creative solutions that can be looked at, but those of us who can should. And right now we make it hard for people to do this. Some of the companies that that produce these plans, as you pointed out, there's a question about their actuarial soundness over time because of some of the same concerns that came up about the CLASS Act with the concepts of adverse selection and sustainability.
Right. Plus, nobody wants to think about it. Congressman, if you'd please stand by there in Louisville, Texas. It's great to have you, and Howard Gleckman in Washington. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about long-term care, booted from the Obama health care reforms, and what America's seniors and more are going to do. Congressman Burgess, Howard Gleckman, lots of response online here. Greg points out that this provision, he says, was supposed to provide 40% of the quote-unquote savings in Obamacare. He says it's unraveling. Here's another listener. Truth says, the only people who will have a sound care in their old age will be the politicians who spent their whole political career fighting socialized medicine. Well, we can talk about that. But Howard Gleckman, this was supposed to provide for a big piece of the savings that the president has talked about to the country.
That's right. As I mentioned before, according to the budget scoring of the Congressional Budget Office, this scored within this first 10 years, which is all anybody ever cared about, is about $80 billion of new revenues. Now, in the long run, that money would have been paid out in benefits. But I think the budget scoring is less important than the real issue, which still goes back to this question of how on earth are we going to pay for this care. Congressman Burgess bought a long-term care insurance policy. With all respect, he's a physician. His income was probably quite a bit higher than the average American. Long-term care insurance premiums are about $2,000 a year. Most people can't afford it. They need some other alternative, and Medicaid, as I suspect he would agree, is probably not the alternative either. Medicaid is under tremendous financial pressure itself. The House Republican budget proposed making dramatic cuts in Medicaid spending. So the question is, if no Medicaid, if no CLASS, if people don't want to buy private insurance, what do we do?
Congressman Burgess, how do you picture this working? And as you point out, people who can buy it should buy it, and you have 7 million in total. That's great, but it's a tiny fraction of those who are headed toward those years. So what's it going to look like? Is it going to be, you know, disabled oldsters and I don't know what, the street kind of poorhouse things, neighborhood care? Is it all going to come on the shoulders of their children to care for them? What do you envision, Congressman?
Well, I think the important thing is that we are talking about it, and it is a problem that is solvable. The $2,000 premium that you reference is about what I pay for myself and my wife. I wish that were something I could take out of my medical savings account. I cannot under current law. I wish that were something for which I could receive a tax deduction. I cannot under current law. We could make it more important to people if we would show that it was important to us. The individual, or you said, I think, Tom, that when I was a physician, I could afford things like that. I assure you, I earned more as a physician than I do in public service. But still, even in public service, this is just something that you budget for. The same type of premium would have had to be paid by people in the CLASS Act, and perhaps even a higher premium than what I pay now for a thinner benefit. So it's not that, you know, the loss of this does not trouble me at all. And the presence of the Class Act worried me because I thought people were going to say, oh, the government's got that one, I don't have to worry about it. No, you do have to worry about it. It's part of your financial planning. It's part of your life planning. It's part of the things that you need to do as a responsible adult, a responsible American.
Howard Glickman,
it doesn't
trouble Congressman Burgess, Howard, but you know, is it troubling to you? I mean, what's the picture that you see coming without something out there?
Well, it's a catastrophe that's coming. It's important to keep in mind that most people receive their care at home. People say long-term care, they think nursing home, but really 80% of people who receive care get it at home. And their caregivers are largely family members. They're usually adult daughters who are trying to hold down a job, care for their own children, care for their own husbands, and now care for their parents and often their husband's parents. This is an untenable situation. They often have to cut back hours of their own work or even quit their jobs, which not only reduces their income today, but it will reduce their retirement income. It means less Social Security benefits. It means less retirement benefits. And it means that they will then be under pressure to go on to Medicaid at some point.
In a way, we're stacking all this on future generations because that Medicaid then gets
like
paid by the
so
next.
So many other things. We're stacking this onto future generations, and we need to come up with a sustainable model. Every other major developed country on the planet, with the exception of the United States and the United Kingdom, has created a universal long-term care insurance program. And it works quite well in all of those other countries. The United Kingdom has just gotten another report from a high-level panel, which also calls for a universal system. So this is not anything unusual. We are the outlier here. And there's a way to create a universal, self-sustaining long-term care insurance program that does not drain the budget and does what Congressman Burgess talks about, which is make it possible for people to take responsibility for their own long-term care. For the life of me, I don't understand why Republicans of all people oppose the idea of creating an insurance-based system rather than relying on the Medicaid welfare-based system that we have today.
Congressman, I want to bring that to you.
Absolutely should be an insurance-based system. But the problem with the CLASS Act, as designed, I buy a long-term care insurance, and I understand there is a specific benefit. With the CLASS Act, under the way the legislation was written, once you qualify for the benefit, it just continues indefinitely. No wonder the program was actuarially unsound. And don't forget, there was going to be a premium assessed on working Americans to pay for the CLASS Act. Yes, it was voluntary, but I would submit to you that premium is not a whole lot different from what I am paying as an individual for a long-term care policy that I hope for myself and my wife.
It wasn't going to be free. Yeah.
If people will just take the time to make that investigation themselves and do the responsible thing for their families.
If they can afford it, if things work out. We've got a lot of callers on exactly this point. Congressman, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, Jim is calling. Jim, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
First of all, I would like to mention that one thing that people should realize is that sometimes this process of getting old is sequential. I had put money in the bank in addition to my annuity and what have you, which I hoped would carry me partially into my old age. Mm-hmm. I lost a lot of it, like a lot of us did.
Yep.
A few years ago, I developed prostate cancer, which made me ineligible to try to get long-term health insurance until I waited some period of time. Then I developed chronic pain issues, which put me on narcotics that I continue to take. I can't get long-term health insurance as long as I'm on those, and I'll probably be on the rest of my life. Frankly, if someone said to me that I could get it for $150 a month, I would whine, because nobody wants to pay $150 a month. I would pay it if I could even get it. And I think there are other people like me. I'm 68 now. These issues started when I was 57 with the prostate cancer.
Right.
So it's been a downhill slide. I mean, I'm functioning. I work part-time, what have you. I'm still functional. I can't get long-term health insurance.
Things happen that make that hard, and we hear your story, Jim, and I appreciate it. Let me get one more. Ken in Carlisle, Massachusetts. Ken, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My wife and I bought long-term care insurance In 2002,
okay.
We bought sort of rich a policy as we thought we could afford. We thought we were reasonably set, and then to our great surprise and really great displeasure, early in 2008, we got a notice from our company, Monumental Life Insurance Company of Cedar Rapids, Iowa,
okay.
That our policies, our premiums were going up. The company was
That's
not
monumental.
Correct in telling us how much they mm-hmm. were going up. I'm an economist by training, and I started digging around, and it turns out that our division of insurance had allowed them to increase premiums by over 70%.
Oh.
Exactly is right. Now, the increase didn't come in instantly. It was allowed to be phased in three annual steps of 20% apiece.
Still, that's big, especially on a fixed
income.
It's
enormous, given the fact that anything could always happen. But I was 63 at the time we bought this insurance. A few years later, we got this enormous increase.
Ken, forgive me, but I need to take that to Congressman Burgess right now. He's got to leave us. Congressman, you hear the story here from Pittsburgh, from my backyard here. People who can't get it or got it, and then they got these big rate hikes, and suddenly maybe they can't afford it anymore. I mean, you know the pitfalls that come here, Congressman. How do we really deal with that?
Well, that underscores the actuarial difficulty with creating this program within the government. The fact that
this was private insurance that Ken had, private.
That it meant that it was going to be subsidized by the taxpayer, and that if you have this system set up through the government, that's exactly where it's going to go. Unfortunately, we also have subsidies coming to the exchanges. We've also doubled our Medicaid population in this country under the Affordable Care Act, and we will reach a point beyond which we cannot sustain further subsidies for further insurance products. The individual who didn't buy till he was 68 years old, yeah, I wish his mom had advised him, too, to buy it before he turned 50. When the people who are listening today, I encourage you, if you're around age 50, look into this. It is something that you can do for yourself, and you won't have to depend on the government in the future.
But here's somebody who bought it when they were sick.
The Class Act story,
yeah.
You may not be able to depend on the government in the future.
But our caller buys it in his early 60s. Okay, it's late, but he was willing to step up and pay for it. Then, boom, a 70% increase. You know what that's like. You can see how people are going to fall out of their private plan, even if they've tried to do it right.
Well, those increases were going to occur in the Class Act, weren't they? The fact that it's a government program
mm-hmm.
did not insulate it from the possibility of premium increases. That is a fact of life with this type of insurance. Yeah, I've had premium increases, too. I didn't like it, but at the same time, I made the decision to continue the coverage because I thought it was in my best long-term interest, and the value the policy was delivering was something I wanted to maintain. People have to make those decisions on their own. There would still be premium increases under the Class Act, and I think everyone will acknowledge that, and that, in fact, was part of the problem. Without substantial premium increases, which would drive people out of the insurance, or without substantial subsidy from federal taxes, this thing was a non-starter.
We're up against a big challenge here. Congressman Michael Burgess of Texas, Vice Chair of the Subcommittee on Health in the Congress. Congressman, thank you very much for being with us today.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Howard, let me get a couple more callers right here. Phil in Clarksville, Tennessee. Phil, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Okay.
You know, this is a pretty apropos story for my family. My father's funeral is, in fact, tomorrow.
I'm sorry.
Dad had a stroke about 15 years ago. He only needed full-time, 24-hour at-home care for the last month.
Okay.
My mother, my parents were both school teachers. Not wealthy people.
Yep.
However, they had purchased long-term care insurance years ago, high premiums. However, they believed it was the right thing to do.
Yep.
My mother was very comforted by the fact that they had long-term care insurance when it got to the point about a month ago that my father did need around-the-clock care at home.
Yes.
She was very, very, we were all very upset and disheartened to find that there was a 100-day deductible in the details of the policy.
Yeah.
My parents are well-educated, but they understand insurance policies. They did not, however, understand that there was effectively a 100-day deductible, meaning that they had to be out of pocket for at least 100 days before the long-term care insurance kicked in.
So they paid for years. When they needed it, it wasn't there. But it was there in the policy, Phil. It sounds cruel, but I guess, you know, if they had read it, that was there. But here you're about to go have your father's funeral. How do you feel about it?
That I would make for all of your listeners is understand in great detail what is in your long-term care policy so that you are not disappointed.
Phil, I'm sorry for that trial in the last month of your father's life, and we wish your family well. I appreciate your call. Let's go to Mike in Acton, Massachusetts. Mike, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hey, long-term care insurance. So, to be brief, I had the opportunity to take care of my spouse's mother and stepfather, and they both have long-term care insurance.
Okay.
He had a policy that he'd had for many, many years with a company called Unum, and you know, he felt pretty good because he had planned ahead and all that, and it turned out he needed it. Wound up in a nursing home at some point. So Massachusetts nursing homes run around $300 a day.
Ooh.
And the Unum policy did have the 100-day deductible,
mm-hmm.
but it also had it maxed out at $100 a day.
Yeah.
Now, this was a policy that he had had for years, and it probably sounded really good when he got it, $100 a day.
Mm-hmm.
How could it cost more than $100? But turns out that, you know.
There it was. It just didn't cover it.
$100 just doesn't do it.
Yeah,
Grandma is still at home, so that's fine, and she's pretty well, all things considered. So she hasn't had to dip into hers, but we checked it out, and it's similar.
So it's just despite paying all those years, it's not going to cover.
No, it's not even close. The whole concept that the congressman there from Texas is pushing is essentially health care for the rich, health insurance for the rich. It has nothing to do with the vast majority of us who, you know, your only health care policy really is to not get sick.
Mike, I'm sorry your family was up against that, but many, many people are or will be, and I appreciate your call as well. Howard Gleckman, we just got half a minute before the break here. I mean, what are you hearing in these stories that might guide us in how we think about this challenge?
Well, I'm hearing a lot of dissatisfaction with private long-term care insurance, and it is a very challenging issue. As you said, these are the provisions in the policy. These policies are extremely complicated. You've got to read them very carefully. My advice is, before you do one of these, make sure that a lawyer or an independent financial advisor, not the one who sells you the insurance, but somebody else, actually looks at this with you and helps you understand what it is you're getting. That 90-day or 100-day deductible, they call it elimination period, mm-hmm. is very typical of these policies.
Judy Fetter of Georgetown University joins us in just a moment. Howard Gleckman with the Urban Institute is here. You can join us as well. Here's the sound of the kind of a message from the private community, a 2009 television commercial from Sunrise Financial.
3 months after my husband and I retired, he was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease. Now it requires 24-hour care. If we have to move into a skilled nursing facility, we'll burn through our nest egg by my 75th birthday. We just never thought that we'd need long-term care insurance.
One of the greatest risks to your financial future is a long-term care event. Call Sunrise Financial today and schedule an appointment with a long-term care insurance specialist.
For a moment, it looked like the federal government might step in with these reforms and help, but then the numbers not adding up, said Kathleen Sebelius last week. In December of 2009, as the health care bill was being debated in the Senate, Democratic senators held a press conference in Washington to sing the praises of the legislation. Here's Connecticut Senator Chris Dodd singling out this long-term care class act.
This is a voluntary, national voluntary insurance program that helps people with functional impairments access the services and supports that allow them to continue to live their daily lives. The amount of the benefit would depend on the degree of disability, but it would be no less than $50 a day. It can pay for aids like a shower chair or wheelchair ramp, providing for a caregiver, people bring meals, a driver, and a car that could take people back and forth to their work, a place, or other such needs they may have.
Would have been great, maybe, but as structured, I guess, the numbers did not add up. It looks like it's gone. Alvin in Little Rock, Arkansas is calling. Hi, Alvin. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I would just like to say these hidden costs and these hidden provisions in these insurance policies.
Mm.
I had a friend that was laid off work. He got sick.
Yep.
A month and a half after he was off work, he called in for his insurance. They told him he was no longer covered under the insurance policy because he hadn't paid his premiums in 30 days.
Yeah.
We need some sort of health care reform in this country. Nobody has done anything about it in 50 years, and now that we have something, everybody says it's no good. Well, why can't we fix it? Why can't we fix the things that are wrong with it so that we can get help when we have a pre-existing condition, when our children get sick? Why can't we? I've talked to people in Canada. I've talked to people in from England and Canada that I work with, and they said they love their health care system. They don't see a single problem with it.
Alvin, I appreciate your call. Why can't we get something that would work right across the board here? I mean, it's a question. A lot of people, if they're not asking it yet, they may well when it's themselves or their parents in trouble. Judy Fader joins us right now. Alvin, let me go to her. She's in Washington, professor at the Georgetown University Public Policy Institute. She was been in the Health and Human Services Division under the Clinton administration. She's author of Medicaid Financing Crisis. Judy Fader, thanks very much for joining us.
Glad to be here, Tom.
Did the Obama administration do the right thing in essentially dumping long-term care from the health care reform package?
Well, I think that the administration in dealing with the CLASS Act, and I want to correct some of the discussion prior to this, but we know that implementing the program was a challenge. My belief is that they had a great deal of analysis to support them in going forward. The secretary acknowledged that she was making that it needed fixes, the law was designed to be flexible. She had, I believe, those authorities, and I'm quite disappointed to see that they've not gone forward to begin to implement this law, because as you can hear from your callers, we sorely need it. So I'd like to make a couple of corrections to what I've heard. I want to go back to the law itself, and because I think there's some misunderstanding. Actually, when the law, when CLASS was enacted as along with the rest of the Affordable Care Act, the Congressional Budget Office actually judged it to be sustainable over 75 years. So it is quite true that the premiums were collected up front, benefits to be paid later,
yep.
But the overall structure was judged to be sustainable. The second thing is to make clear that the savings didn't help pay for the law. They did contribute the now estimated about $80 billion in premium collection did contribute to deficit reduction.
Right.
But the law, the Affordable Care Act, the health insurance, which your most recent caller was talking about, we are moving forward on that. It didn't contribute to paying for that. So
no,
I think that's
we didn't
that's
say
really
that. We
important.
Said President Obama talked about it as savings for the country. Deficit reduction, as you put it, and he did quite prominently.
Yes, I heard. There's no question. I heard one of the guests talked about it paying for the law. It did not do that. So that's just really important to know. Yeah,
Howard, if I may, what about if the CBO said it was in fact sustainable for 75 years? That's what the Gregg Amendment required. Why would Sebelius walk away from it?
Well, she felt, as Judy said, she felt based on her legal authority. That she did not have the ability to interpret the law in such a way that the design of the insurance program would be sustainable. Now, her own lawyers in their interpretation said that she could probably make many of these changes, but there are some key changes that that her actuaries thought she should make. Where her legal authority was questionable, where the lawyers said this could be challenged in court and we don't know how it's going to come out. As Judy knows very well, you know, a lawsuit involving the Affordable Care Act is hardly anything new.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
I'm not sure why the secretary was so concerned about one more lawsuit, but she seemed to have been, and she decided that she didn't want to take the chance. So the kinds of changes that she needed to make, that her own actuary suggested she make, to make sure that this program really does work, she was just not willing to make. One other point about this, I think that we can get, I think, too hung up in the budget issues here. You know, this isn't about the budget issues.
Well, we've got to pay for it in the end.
Well, of course we do, and that's my point. I mean, mm-hmm. what we need to do is we need to design a program that works, that provides good long-term care insurance for lots of people well into the future. The CLASS Act, again, according to its own actuaries, probably would have only covered about 2 million people. That's a very small number, but it's a start. It's a first step down what would have had to have been a series of other reforms in this. Now, my own sense, I don't know if Judy agrees or not, but my own sense is that we really won't have a really functioning long-term care insurance program until it's a universal mandatory program.
Well, Tommy, may I respond?
There for that
yeah,
right
yeah.
Now.
Howard, stand yeah. by. Judy, first, on the plan itself, if you'd be good enough.
Sure.
If there were ways to make it sustainable, why do you think the Obama administration has walked away from it? And then what about the bigger challenge here? What structure might help us deal with it?
Right. So I think Howard has said it well and clearly that the determination was made not to take a legal risk. I am saddened that the administration did not stand up for this, and I feel
but
why? Strongly
why,
that they
why
should.
Didn't they? There's lots of suits out there, as he says, and you acknowledge.
Hey, Tom, that's, your guess is as good as mine. I think that the reluctance to stand up for it is a disappointment, and the administration is standing strong on the on a mandate that we would like to see on all insurance to make it work so that healthy people buy and we have a sustainable sharing of risk. That's a big problem with a voluntary social insurance program. I'd like to see them standing up for the aggressive implementation of the full act. You'll have to ask them why they have not decided to take the risk on this one.
And what about the bigger challenge? You hear Alvin in Little Rock says, isn't there a way to make this work?
Well, Alvin was saying, I think, when he talked about his children, I thought Alvin was talking about the Affordable Care Act more broadly. And let me be really clear that that is going forward. And so on health insurance and with respect to requirements, as Howard's talking about, we are going forward. So that's really, really important to emphasize. What Howard asked is, don't we really need a similar requirement, mandatory insurance on long-term care? Ideally. Absolutely. But I think it is very important to recognize that what we have with CLASS, and it's not fully gone, I'm hanging by a thread here. What we have is a hook for the beginning of as a public commitment to long-term care insurance. And despite Congressman Burgess's claims, mm-hmm. Private insurance is not going to make it. The companies are leaving the business. Howard called it failed. He's correct. People are having trouble putting money away for pensions, let alone private long-term care insurance. And as we heard from your callers, those insurers are not reliable. What a government program, even a limited one, offers is an opportunity to put government behind an education, a marketing effort. It can actually support the purchase of private long-term care insurance alongside a modest public benefit. We need a full-scale public investment, and that's why it's disappointing that we are not going forward with this first step, which is what I believe CLASS to be. The last piece is Congressman Burgess's claims that he's going to solve this with a tax credit. One of your callers called that support for the rich. That's exactly what it is.
Why?
Because the tax benefits the high-income population and is likely simply to replace some of the dollars that better-off people are already paying in premiums. That is not a solution for the public at large.
Howard, I'll come to you. Let me get a call from Loretta in Donaldson, Iowa. Loretta, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My point is that Medicaid is already paying for a lot of the long-term care. So the government's already paying for it because a lot of the richer people, the people that have a small business or can switch their assets over to someone else in the length of legal time, I think it's 6 years.
Okay.
I'm not certain about that.
Yeah.
But then Medicaid is the one that's covering a lot of people in the nursing homes now. So if you don't have a good lawyer or you don't have a method to incorporate yourself with something, then those are the ones that are getting stuck. It's all the individual people that don't have the money to do it.
Loretta, let us look at that, if we may. Judy?
Yeah, sure.
I mean, you know what she's talking about. People empty the piggy bank if they have a lawyer or can figure out how to do it so that they qualify and protect their assets somehow, and then Medicaid's covering them.
Yeah, that does happen. But the reality for your caller is that the vast majority of people are going into nursing homes don't have the significant assets to transfer. So that issue, as it arises, is grossly exaggerated. People are exhausting their resources. Nobody wants to go into a nursing home. We know that. And we know that most people don't have the wealth to pay for it.
But you either protect it or lose it, or, as you say, don't have it in the first place if you end up on the Medicaid tab. We're looking at long-term care. Howard,
I've
heard...
go ahead, Tom.
Well, I just wanted to ask about the sustainability. I mean, a lot of people do depend on Medicaid, Howard. But what about the sustainability of that? As you say, we go from 11 million who need long-term care to maybe 20 million, and the boomers are, go into that zone, Howard.
So Medicaid is under enormous financial pressure already. If you look at what governors have been doing with their Medicaid programs over the last few years, it's dramatic, and it's heading in the wrong direction. The Democratic governor of California, Jerry Brown, has eliminated funding for adult day programs under the California Medicaid program called Medi-Cal. That's the kind of thing that's happening around the country. So it is true that people rely on Medicaid. But they're relying on a safety net that's going to be increasingly frayed. When we look at federal deficit reduction over the next few years, I don't think there's any question that Medicaid is going to be one of the targets. It's important to remember that Medicaid does two things. It provides health care, acute health care for mothers and their children, and it provides this long-term care. And 30% of Medicaid expenditures, $120 billion a year, is paid for long-term care. So whatever kind of a safety net Medicaid provides today, and it's not great, it's going to be a much less generous benefit in the years to come. So again, the question is, and this is what I was asking Congressman Burgess before, the question is, if we're not going to have class and we're not going to have Medicaid and nobody wants to buy private long-term care insurance, what are we going to do?
Let me get one more call. Eric in Newton, Massachusetts. Eric, you're on the air. Make it short if you can, sir.
Hi, Tom. Just two observations to make about Medicaid. One is similar to your previous caller. I worked briefly for a firm that helped affluent people plan to protect their assets for Medicaid in the future so they would be eligible.
Yeah.
And I don't think that's wrong. It's just a reality.
How about your family, Eric?
And my mom, we recently took care of in our home this past summer. She passed away from pancreatic cancer. She had modest means. Her worst fear was to go to a nursing home. We could have used her funds to do that. We didn't want to do that for her. And I think that it's interesting, if we had exhausted her funds, ultimately the cost of being in a nursing home, had she gone there, is anywhere from maybe $5,000 to $10,000 a month. And I don't quite understand why Medicaid wouldn't allow you to use those monies or some portion of them to have assistance in your home. It would go a long
way. Eric, we've got it. I mean, it leaves us with a big question here, Judy. What are we going to do? Are we going to have just millions of people with... I don't know, without care or waiting for their 50-something-year-old children to get home from work to change their diapers?
Well, I'm not prepared to give up the fight for good public programs that we've got. And as we talk about the threats to Medicaid, let's focus on the super committee and efforts for deficit reduction right now. I would urge our listeners to pay attention to that debate and be concerned about any lids or caps that are put on financing for Medicaid, whether it's for long-term care for people, dual eligibles, Medicare and Medicaid, or anybody else. We need to continue those resources. So that's not a place to look for deficit reduction. We need it. And over the longer term, we need to move toward a public program. Otherwise, the burdens fall to families who are already overburdened and not able to give adequate care. So we need to keep on working.
Well, for today, this week, That's not happening. So watch the public debate. Watch your private back to the extent you can. And good luck. It is a big, big challenge. Judy Fader at Georgetown University's Public Policy Institute. Thanks for joining us, Judy.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Howard Gleckman with the Urban Institute, author of Caring for Our Parents. Thank you for being here, Howard.
Thank you, Tom.
Thanks for joining us, listeners. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.